Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and authors who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. Our sponsor for the first season is Park Road Books, the oldest and only full-service independent bookstore in Charlotte. They're located in Park Road Shopping Center. They've got a great staff and an awesome collection of books. And if they don't have something in stock that you want, they can order it for you and have it there quickly. And please check out our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. You can get information about the show and about our guest authors. We'd love to have you become a regular listener. You can listen on iTunes or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And on our website, you can sign up for our email list. We promise not to spam you, just give you updates from time to time about the show. And if you do join, as a thank you, we'll give you a free ebook, the first in a trilogy written by your host. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. Today, author Judy Goldman reads one of her published poems entitled Sunday Night Driving Home, where the reader can feel themselves as children settling into the back seat as the hum of the highway in the dark of night puts them at ease. She also reads from a new book, Together, a memoir of a marriage and a medical mishap, due for publication by Doubleday in February 2019. New York Times bestselling authors Ron Rash and Wiley Cash speak glowingly of the new book. And finally, she reads from her book, Losing My Sister, a finalist for both Southeast Booksellers Alliance Memoir of the Year and Ford Review's Memoir of the Year.
Sunday night, driving home. If I close one eye, the light from the dial looks like the tip of a cigarette, and my mother is smoking, the small fingers of her left hand moving to her lips, then to the curve of the front seat close to my father's shoulder. Her hand is a pigeon in the shadows that fly in from the road. My sister and I lie across the back seat, our shoes touching, each of us resting on a pillow pressed to the glass. I think my sister is sleeping. She's missing the talk from the front seat, how Aunt Katie seems worse and maybe should be taken away for a while. My mother appears to nod instead of saying the word yes to my father. I hear less and less of their low tones until suddenly the sound of wheels spinning gravel, and I know without opening my eyes we are home. I also know that my father will first lift my sister and carry her in, return for me, placing me lightly in the narrow bed next to hers, folding the sheet back over the blanket and smoothing it flat with the palm of his hand. Then he'll touch my face, listen to me breathe, and reach for the switch on the lamp that separates our twin beds like the tall brass branch of a family tree.
Judy Goldman is the author of 6 books, 2 memoirs, 2 novels, and 2 books of poetry. Judy has won many prizes and awards for her work, which has appeared in the Southern Review, Kenyon Review, Gettysburg Review, Ohio Review, Prairie Schooner, Shenandoah, Crazy Horse, and Real Simple Magazine. She received the Hobson Award for Distinguished Achievement in Arts and Letters, the Fortner Writer and Community Award for Outstanding Generosity to Other Writers in the Larger Community, and the Beverly D. Clark Award from Queen's University. Judy is a very accomplished author and advocate for the writing community. Judy, welcome to the show.
Oh, boy, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, now that was a nice little poem there. That it almost feels like that's a memory etched in your brain, is it?
You know, that is so right. That's exactly the way to say that. It is etched in my brain. And one of the reasons it's etched in my brain, Landis, is I have used that poem in almost every book I've written.
Is that right?
I just keep plagiarizing from myself.
Well, I mean, you've got this vision, almost like your first day of school or playing catch with your dad in the yard. It's just one of those things in childhood, being in the back seat on a dark country road, coming home, and just feeling the comforting sound of the hum of the wheels.
And, yes, yeah. It's a very sweet, tender memory, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, and there's two sets of people in this story. There are the adults who are up front having a private moment.
Yes.
With their hand grazing his shoulder, and then there are the children in the back in their own world.
Yes, and but the children in their own world have one ear out, at least this child, the future writer. Probably my sister did not. She was sleeping, of course. But yeah, I had one ear out wanting to hear what the grown-ups were talking about. I was interested in the fact that my mother's sister was going to be, quote-unquote, taken away for a while.
Yeah. But then the tones got lower and lower.
Yeah.
Until the wheels took over, you sort of nodded off.
I think I probably did, yeah.
So, which came first, poetry or prose writing for you?
Oh, absolutely poetry for me. I started writing poetry when I was 8 years old. And in fact, I still have those poems I wrote in the third grade. And then when I was in my 30s, both of my parents were dying at the same time. And I could have taken to my bed, but instead I took to my typewriter, my little Olivetti portable, and I started writing poetry. And wrote poetry for years, 2 poetry books. I was set to be a poet for life, and all of a sudden my lines started getting longer, and I was no longer writing in stanzas. I was yearning to write prose. So I started doing commentaries for public radio. That got me into prose. It eased me into prose. And then I wrote my first novel, and that's really what I was yearning to do, was to write prose. But fiction never felt at home to me. So then I ended up in memoir, which is a circle, because memoir is really close to writing poetry.
But you've written some fiction. Right?
Oh, I wrote 2 novels, But they almost don't count in my brain. I don't know how to invent. I don't want to invent.
All you authors out there, you know, writing 2 novels, it doesn't count.
It does not count. Because I don't know how to make up stories. I just want to tell the stories that happened to me. Memory is what I'm in love with.
Now, this poem, though, the mood is a lot different than at least the titles of your 2 memoirs. I mean, we're going from comfort to tragedy, right?
Yes.
And no.
But within tragedy, there's hope.
Gotcha.
There's optimism.
Sure.
I think that what I like to write about is the difference between the life we dream of and the life we make.
That's a great...
You know, I mean, we envision what our life will be, and then things happen. And then we make a life based on what we're left with. That's what interests me in memoir.
You're going to be reading from 2 of those books today, one that's going to be coming out soon. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then one you wrote about your sister. And I just want, just before we get into those, just a little bit about memoir writing. You're right. I mean, you can't tell this story without bringing in all the emotions, correct? I mean, you've got humor, you've got life changes, you've got sadness.
And you have...
hope.
Yes. Okay. And you have your own reflection or your analysis or your interpretation of all those memories and the emotions they brought.
Right. But in order for it to be readable, so to speak, it has to be something that also tugs at the emotions of the reader. It can't just be a story about what happened on X date and Y date and so forth. You actually weave your storytelling skills into your memoir, correct?
Well, that's what we try to do, and that's what we hope we're doing. Yeah. I mean, I hope I'm saying to the reader, this is what happened to me, and that would be boring. That would just be a diary entry or a journal entry.
Right.
But what I hope lifts it from that is my reflection and my interpreting for the reader what it means, and then maybe the reader connects with that reflection, and that leads the reader into his or her own memory that might be similar to mine or really in opposition to mine.
Well, you've already gotten a lot of good press from some very respected authors about this new book that's coming out. So you've had it out there and people have been reading it, right? Just not the general public yet, right?
I have been very fortunate. Yeah, really nice, wonderful writers.
Ron Rash, Wally Cash, they're really touting this book. So I don't want to keep our readers, our listeners in suspense too much longer.
I'm sure they're panting to hear.
Well, we can't read the whole memoir on the show, but we're going to read a little bit of it. And first of all, give us the title of the new book.
Okay, the title is Together, and the subtitle is A Memoir of a Marriage and a Medical Mishap.
All right, and before we start, that title intrigued me as well. The subtitle, I mean, so you've got Memoir of a Marriage and a Medical Mishap. We're going to hear a part of this book that focuses on this medical mishap.
Yes, yes.
I'm assuming that this book is going to speak to what you and your husband dealt with in your own marriage, either collaterally from this mishap or maybe even beyond that.
Well, yeah. And before that.
And before that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It's really the trajectory of our marriage, which is probably not so different from your marriage or anybody else's marriage, because if we're together long enough, there are going to be big changes, right?
Sure.
Sometimes they're slow changes, gradual changes, the ones we expect.
I might learn how to use the dishwasher. Right?
You have to learn how to use the dishwasher. We're going to talk more about that later, Landis. Okay, going to be part of this podcast.
That'll be part of the training.
Oh, boy, I'm going to work on you. Okay. But we
I know how to get them in the dishwasher.
Listen, that's a pet.
And get them out of the dishwasher. Just pushing those buttons, that's the part.
Yeah. Well, somebody else can push the button, but you need to get the dishes in and out. Okay. But here's the thing. We not only experience gradual, slow changes, we experience abrupt, dramatic changes, and then our roles shift. And that's where the challenge comes in, but that's also where opportunity comes in. Those big changes in marriage, how do we adjust? How can we make it work now? That's the secret, I think. We've been married 51 years, and I think we've learned a few things, although we're still learning. We have a lot to learn. But I think that is the secret, expecting those changes and expecting roles to shift.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any reservations about opening up your personal marriage to the entire world here?
That sort of makes me nervous just hearing you say that.
You still got time.
Do you think I have time?
Oh my gosh. I think it's going to come out anyway.
It is such a risk to write memoir. Yeah. Such a risk. I mean, you can look. You appear small-minded, you appear petty, you appear obsessed, you appear narcissistic. It's a big risk writing memoir and opening yourself up. But it's what we do. I mean, whether we write fiction or nonfiction, memoir or novels, we're putting ourselves out there waiting to be judged.
Right. Well, let's hear a little bit of the new book.
Okay, this is from chapter one. Henry and I are at the kitchen table eating breakfast. Grape nuts, sliced banana, milk for him, oatmeal for me with walnuts chopped small, fresh blueberries and dried cranberries, mugs of coffee. I did not always drink coffee. My feeling was that it never tasted as good as it smelled. But with enough half and half, I like it now. Funny how we describe ourselves. One minute we're, oh, I'm not a coffee drinker, never touch it. The next, we're solidly in another camp. Have to have coffee every morning. Who we are can flip like that. The details always shifting. Henry picks up the sports section, folds it in half, then half again, pushes the rest of the Charlotte Observer to the far side of the table. I've got the living section. It's mid-February 2006. Outside, wintry and windy and wet. Doesn't this sound like a good idea, he says, pointing to an ad I can't read from where I'm sitting. A non-surgical procedure for back pain done by a physiatrist. What's a physiatrist? I asked, scooting my chair closer so that I can read even the small print. According to the ad, physiatrists are MDs, he says. Apparently, they treat spinal problems. 6 years ago, Henry had surgery for spinal stenosis, which helped some, but his back has never really stopped hurting. He's stiff when he gets out of bed in the morning, can't stand for long, finds a chair pretty quickly wherever he happens to be. He lives a normal life, though. A normal life with backaches. He's so athletic, what he'd really like is to be able to jog again, play racquetball, tennis. Yes, I say, that does sound like a good idea. The physiatrist tells Henry he believes he can help. From what I can understand, he'll use fluoroscopy for guidance while he injects steroids and an anesthetic into the epidural space between the spine and the spinal cord. The procedure will take about 30 minutes, followed by maybe 45 minutes of recovery time. Henry will be monitored for an additional 15 to 20 minutes, then discharged to go home. An hour and a half total. Compare this to hours on an operating table, days in the hospital, the long recuperation that back surgery entails. This injection is so common, it's given to women during childbirth. The physiatrist explains that an epidural steroid injection can be highly effective because it delivers pain relief directly to the source of the problem. He recommends 2 injections spaced 3 weeks apart. He needs to inject 2 different areas. As with all invasive procedures, there are risks. Generally, though, the risks are few and tend to be rare. Headache, infection, bleeding, nerve damage. Henry signs the consent form. A week later, we report to the hospital outpatient clinic for the first epidural. Afterward, Henry's right leg is numb. Very little feeling. The physiatrist, a tall fellow with a friendly face and thick, hay-colored hair anyone would envy, says something like, "The numbness is a great sign. It means the epidural is working." Henry's leg is so numb he can barely walk. He leans on me as I help him from the car into our house and to our bed. He goes right to sleep, which is unusual for him. I don't think I've ever seen him take a nap. The little bit of walking he did completely exhausted him. I keep checking the handout. If numbness persists longer than 8 hours, call the office. Every hour I wake Henry to ask about the numbness. Every hour he says his leg is still numb. Then he drifts back off. I don't relax my shoulders for a minute. The 8th hour, I have my hand on the phone ready to dial. I ask him one last time. All feeling has returned. No need to call. My shoulders relax. His second epidural is scheduled for 3 weeks from now. But first, our vacation, planned months ago on the French side of the island of St. Martin. The romance of spending long days in 2 chaises pull close, our bare toes touching. How warm we are from the sun, lost in our books. Less than 100 feet away, our lunch place juts out over the sea, the smoky grill, the smell of fresh-caught fish cooking. Evenings, we stroll the rutted mile from our small resort to the row of Caribbean-colored gingerbread cottage restaurants. Henry's back is still hurting, so we have to stop every now and then for him to stretch, backward, forward, bending way over, hands on knees. But a little pain is not going to keep him from what he wants to do. The moon's soft light catches the sea grape leaves all around us. We debate the menus posted on the little front porches. Our main concern, are we in the mood for muscles or soul? 7 days after St. Martin, we leave early for our 1:45 appointment at the same hospital outpatient clinic as before. It's one of those golden North Carolina days that always make me wonder why anyone would ever want to live anywhere else. Pure sunlight, air fragrant. Henry checks in. There are so many people here, the waiting room feels tight. The only available chairs together are catty corner, a square table in between. But no sooner do we sit down than a nurse comes to take Henry back. She has an air of efficiency about her, the way she holds her head and her shoulders, her sensible nurse shoes. I didn't know anybody still wore those. She says she'll call for me in a few minutes after they get him ready. I can keep him company while he waits for the doctor. I pick up People magazine and settle in, even though I don't recognize the names of any of the celebrities. I glance at my watch. How did it get to be 3 o'clock? Why aren't they coming for me? At 3:30, a nurse, not the same one who took him back, but a shiny-faced young woman, perky, smiley, appears and says that my husband has had the epidural. Oh, I say, I thought somebody was going to come get me so I could be with him before. Well, she says, we're real busy today and things got sort of hectic back there, and then the doctor was all of a sudden ready for him around 3 o'clock, and we just never had a chance to come get you. I walk behind her down the long hall. She's repeating brightly, your husband's very numb, as though she's marveling over some unusual turn of events, more amusing, really, than anything to worry about. He's numb, I ask, trying to match her brightness, wondering why my little laugh is coming out shaky. She stops outside a closed door, pauses, opens it. I follow her in. When she moves to the side and Henry is in full view, I see that he's flat on his back on a gurney, a sheet pulled up around his neck the way you'd tuck in a child. His expression is contorted, his whole face an agonized flinch, as though he took the world head on and lost. Judy, he whispers, his eyes clutching at mine. I can't feel a thing from my waist down. I can't move my legs. I turn to the nurse. Where's the doctor? My voice rises with each word, going someplace totally unfamiliar. Does the doctor know? Well, she says, not exactly. He needs to see this. My voice verges on shrill. My hand brushes the air. Go, get the doctor. Please, ask him to come in here. She's backing out of the room. I'm shivering. I sit down beside Henry, put my hand on his arm. I don't know where to touch him, if it's even okay to touch him. Tell me, I say. He says that when the doctor was giving the injection, he felt severe pain. He must have groaned because the doctor asked him, are you okay? He told the doctor, no, I'm not okay. I'm in excruciating pain. The doctor said, we're almost done. Then he finished the injection. Henry tells me that his back, where the needle went in, still hurts. Maybe it's not as bad as I'm terrified that it is. Maybe he's really all right. Maybe I can help him be all right. Maybe what's been taken away can be brought back. I just have to figure this out, but I need to hurry before it, whatever it is, locks into place. I loosen the sheet around his feet. Can you feel this? I scratch his bare toes. No, he says, not at all. He sounds as though he's grown tired somewhere deep in his body. Can you wiggle your toes? I'm trying. Are they moving? They aren't. I wiggle them myself to get them started, but then nothing. Can you flex this foot or this one? I can't make either one move. How about your leg? I tap his knee through the sheet. Can you lift your leg? Can you lift it just a little? This one or this one? I'm trying. I'm trying as hard as I can. I stroke the tops of his feet, then the soles with my fingers. For a second, I think how another time, another place, I might run my hand down his calf to his foot. Maybe in the morning, on my way to the bathroom, rounding the bed, I might reach under the sheet and touch the bottom of his foot, that careless, offhanded thing married people do. What about this, I ask, massaging his ankles. Can you feel me doing this? I can't. Now I'm reaching under the sheet and rubbing his calves. No. I reach farther and touch his knees, thighs, groin, buttocks. No, 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 no. He feels nothing. I feel everything. 1 minute, you're complaining that the zinc-based sunscreen you're supposed to wear in the Caribbean goes on like Elmer's glue. The next, you're Googling paralysis. Everything is okay, then nothing is. That thin line, how a brush fire can erupt on a perfectly sunny, clear-skied day. How your life can be taken right out of your hands.
Judy, was that hard to read?
Well.
I'm listening, and it is, you know, as every paragraph and every sentence moves forward, you just know this isn't going to turn out well.
And, you see where it's going, huh?
You see where it's going.
It's not hard to read, interestingly, because this event took place in 2006.
Okay. So we're 12 years later.
Yeah, we're 12 years later. I did not plan to write about this either. I never intended to write about it, although I took notes beginning at that moment. When that happened, at that moment, when he couldn't feel anything, I pulled a paper towel from the dispenser on the wall and started taking notes. And I took notes for years. But it was only so that I could take good care of him, so that I could keep everything straight, so that I could make him okay. It was not to write a book.
And when you say take notes, you mean you're recording what was happening at the time that he couldn't,
yes.
He didn't have feeling here and he didn't have
I wrote everything down. And like I say, I never intended to write this book, but I was the victim of a holdup at the dry cleaners 2 years after the epidural that my husband had. And the holdup did not frighten me. It made me sad. Mm-hmm. And I cried and cried and cried over the holdup. And I realized at that point, the holdup felt exactly the same to me as the epidural. And now I can cry over what happened to my husband for the first time. Because, again, how our lives can mm-hmm. be taken right out from under us. And I started writing about the holdup, which led me to writing about my husband.
Something stolen from you and your husband.
Exactly. Yeah. But so, Landis, 2008 is when the holdup happened.
Right.
So 2018, and the book's going to come out in 2019. So that many years I've been working on it. So that's a long answer to, is that hard to read? This is just material to me now. It's what I've been working on for so many years.
So before I talk about this chapter here, where did this story in real life progress to? How is your husband doing?
Well, thank you for asking that. He's do you know who John Wayne was? You know John Wayne. Okay,
yeah.
Some people don't know John Wayne anymore.
True Grit.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I love that movie. Yeah. Well, my husband is a John Wayne. He's very strong-willed. He's very tough. And he now, one leg came back. Okay. One leg is still paralyzed. So he's gone from a wheelchair to a walker to a four-prong cane to a regular cane.
Okay.
So he's better off now than he was in that chapter I just read.
I mean, that must have been an extremely terrifying moment for both of you in that waiting room, or the post-operative room.
Yes.
After this happened.
Yes. Pretty terrifying.
Just the thought of that, I mean, as you read this, of course, I'm a lawyer, and the first thing I want to do is go sue the guy. Are there chapters in here that deal with legal issues?
Well, you know, in my subtitle, I call it a mishap.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't totally know what happened. I don't even know that the doctors totally know what happened.
And I jumped the gun a bit. I mean, you're obviously what leads you to that conclusion, perhaps, is the hurriedness that's going on. They rush him through. The doctor's busy.
Yes.
You're naturally thinking, but then there could be another explanation as well.
Yeah, and that's the state of medicine today,
right.
The rush.
It doesn't mean necessarily that they did anything wrong. It just
Exactly. And in fact, further into my book, I deal with my anger toward the physiatrist mm-hmm. and how it's not right, the anger, because we all, even if he made a mistake, we all make mistakes. He was trying to make my husband better, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
That's what he hoped to do. That's what I hoped he would do. Things happen. Mm-hmm. That's life. Changes occur. Mistakes, accidents, mishaps occur.
Well, that's a great attitude. It's harder to keep that attitude.
It's a hard
in the moment.
It's a hard won attitude. Yeah, don't forget, I have been working on this book for many years, and writing is a way to work it out in your mind, too.
How did your husband feel about you writing this book?
He is so used to my writing about our family. I have been writing about my poor beleaguered family for as long as they can remember.
They know that the camera's on when they're around
you. Exactly. It's what they signed on for. When he said, I do, he signed on for being written about by me.
That was like a consent form right there.
It is. Exactly. He signed on and he's there. Okay. He's my first reader with everything. I've taught him to give me lots of compliments first and then say what he thinks I should change. He's well trained.
Good. Well, one thing that caught my attention here, you mentioned St. Martin's. My wife and I have been to St. Martin's.
Oh, boy.
It's a lovely island. It's a great way to escape. And we've been on the French side.
Yes, that part is beautiful.
So I can see that idyllic space there compared to what you set up for us in this operating room, post-op room. And then you really hammer this home at the end of this chapter with this confluence of events. He feels nothing. I feel everything. And then how a brush fire can erupt on a perfectly sunny, clear-skied day. I mean, that's what accidents are all about, right? I mean, it's something, everything's going along just fine.
We don't
expect things change.
Yeah, we don't expect them. When your HVAC breaks and it turns to 93 degrees in your house, which is what happened to us last couple of weeks ago.
I mean, that's one thing. It's not the same thing.
It's not what, but any accident is not what we expect. Any change in our normal everyday doings, we don't expect it. We're not prepared. It's a shock.
It is. So what are the silver linings to this story? Well, you talked about hope earlier on about memoir. What comes out of this story that you see as the silver lining to this, what started off to be a medical mishap?
Here's the silver lining for my husband and me. When we got married, he was 6'1". I was just barely 5'3". He was big and strong and brave and athletic. I was small, shy, not courageous, not athletic. I say that I was like Patty Hearst. I married my bodyguard. I mean, he was going to protect me. I was going to be the protectee. All of a sudden, this accident happened, and now I'm protecting him. So what happened for me is I discovered the strength that was really mine all along, but I just didn't know it was there. And we also discovered how much strength it still took on the part of my husband to face the obstacles that he was now facing every day. So in a sense, we always acknowledged his strength, but he came to know a different kind of strength in himself. And then I learned that I was pretty strong after all. The hard-earned wisdom of writing memoir is discovering patterns and really discovering the core of who we are.
And did it also change your marriage? Did it change the way that you interacted with each other? Did it improve the relationship? Did it alter the relationship in any way?
That is a really good question, and one I really have to think about, because in some ways, it did not change the marriage. We are still two people who love each other like mules. I mean, we're just there, the mules, right in there.
The mules love each other.
Yeah, that's a weird thing for me to say, and I don't know where that came from exactly, but but we'll go with it.
We'll go with that.
But we still fall in bed with each other like we did the first year we were married. I mean, we've still got that strong attachment. I guess we also learned the strength in each other, and so we admire that in each other. But there were bumpy places along the way, certainly. I mean, we both wanted to reverse the reversal, and neither one of us could figure out how to do it. And so sometimes he got mad at me just because I was loading the dishwasher what he thought was the wrong way. There's a scene in the book about that. And then I got mad at him because he was swallowing 12 pills with one gulp of orange juice, and I wanted him to make three separate piles of pills. And, you know, we picked at each other because we were so unhappy about what was happening. We didn't know who else to take it out on.
How long have you been married?
51 years.
51 years.
Yeah, that's some kind of something, isn't
it? That's a nice record, nice even number.
It is indeed.
Where did you meet?
Well, we met on a blind date. I had moved to New York, and I was working in advertising. And he had moved to Charlotte to open an optometric practice. And we met, like I said, on a blind date. Our sisters fixed us up. That was date number one.
Okay.
I went back to New York. Came home very quickly because I really liked him. So we had date number two. Then he drove his Volkswagen Beetle up to New York for date number three, and that's when we got engaged.
So after 3 dates.
After 3 dates. And the first one was a blind date, and we were not living in the same town.
And 51 years later.
Yeah. I didn't even know his middle name. I knew nothing about him. He knew nothing about me. We just sort of fell in love.
Well, you've obviously made it work.
It was an arranged marriage, almost,
by your sisters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, speaking of sisters, that kind of leads us into this next piece. This was the first memoir you wrote.
It was.
Okay. And it's about your sister, and you and your sister were very close.
We were very, very entangled.
She was your older sister.
I adored her.
She looked after you.
She looked after me. She protected me from bullies. And then sometimes she bullied me because she was the older sister and she could.
All right, we'll talk a little bit about that memoir itself in a moment, but you're going to read an excerpt which is, it doesn't have anything to do with the death of your sister, but it kind of sets up the relationship between you and your sister at a younger age. Is that right?
That's exactly what it does. And you talked earlier about memories and the power of memories. Mm-hmm. That's all this is. This is the very beginning of the memoir, Losing My Sister, and it's just a series of small memories.
Okay.
Here we go, Losing My Sister. Sister stories, breath-thin moments, rise back to air. 5 years old, I can always win over my sister by stuffing my whole fist in my mouth. She huddles with neighborhood friends on the sidewalk, engrossed in whatever it is 8-year-olds do. I hang around the outskirts, waiting for a chance to break in. What can I do that they can't? Well, there are these little tricks I've been practicing. One is saying the alphabet backwards faster than most people can say it forward. But I know that Brenda and her friends will not stay put long enough for me to go from Z to A. Of course, there's this other trick I've perfected. One of Brenda's friends steps back or maybe just turns around briefly, and I quickly slip inside the circle, work my fingers behind my two front teeth, push and grind until my hand disappears all the way up to my bony wrist, and everyone, including my sister, goes, "Gosh." Brenda has me repeat this for other groups. It never fails to astound. When it's just the two of us, we ballet dance in the front yard, arabesques and piquet turns. We wear the lime and fuchsia crepe paper dresses that Maddie, the woman who takes care of our household, who's been part of our family since I was 3, makes for us. We love the pink Tims, the stiff ruffles like wings. We love Maddie, whose brown hands smell like peaches and can turn anything shimmery. I follow Brenda through the grass as though drawn by an invisible cord. We spend hours in our backyard playhouse. We play school, we play store, we play movie stars, we play and play, humming with summer. She's 9, I'm 6. She draws a girl with perfect lips. I draw a girl. My lips don't turn out like her, so I erase, draw again, erase, until there's a dark graphite smear on the bottom third of my girl's face, making her look like she needs a shave. Brenda notices my frustration. "Want me to show you how to do lips?" she asks. When she makes earrings and pins out of seashells from White's Hobby Shop, I make earrings and pins from seashells. We sit at the card table in the den for hours, squeezing the honey-colored glue, sliding the pastel blossoms into place. She changes her design. I change mine. La Petite Beauty Salon places a big order for Brenda's jewelry, sells out, orders more. Brenda objects only a little when Mother asks her if some of my jewelry can be included in the next batch. I would never have thought of such a thing. But Mother says it's what sisters do. Brenda and Judy, we are one long word. A little older, we publish our own neighborhood newspaper. I write the articles and Brenda illustrates. She's also the marketing director, which means she tells me how far up the street I have to go to sell the papers. I listen carefully. I want to get it exactly right. I'm afraid of the ball. To cure me, she ties me to a tree in the front yard with our jump rope and throws a basketball at me over and over and over. "See, Judy," she yells over my sobs, "there's nothing to be scared of, nothing at all."
Sounds like a big sister that was taking advantage of her little sister a couple of times.
Or some sort of torture.
Yeah, and then you've got Brenda and Judy were one long word, kind of like Laverne and Shirley.
Yeah, you might say.
So you and your sister were close growing
up? We were very close. We were raised like twins. In my family, sisters were supposed to be close. My mother was close to her sisters. Her mother was close to her sister. I mean, so for generations, sisters were supposed to be close. Mm-hmm. But, Landis, that's a lot of pressure to put on a relationship.
Mm. Yeah, talk about the book itself, losing your sister, and what happened in that situation.
Here's what happened. I really lost my sister 3 times, twice through temporary but very intense conflict, and then the 3rd time was the most permanent way, when she died of bile duct cancer. So it's really the whole arc of our relationship. The ways that we came together, the ways that we came apart, and then how we finally came apart. Mm. And then I brought us back together again in this book.
There you go. Was that a cathartic moment for you to write that book?
Yeah. It's always cathartic to write, but that's not why I write.
Right.
We cannot write hoping to cure our own obsessions, but we should write about what obsesses us. We should write about what keeps us up at night. But we need to use reflection in memoir, which I've spoken about earlier, to take it to a different level, to turn the personal into the universal.
Now, you said with the marriage and medical mishap, you had never intended to write a memoir. What about with your sister? Did you have in mind that this was something you wanted to do after she died?
I think I have written about my sister a million different ways over the years. That was a very key relationship in my life. I wrote poems about her for years. I wrote commentaries about her for public radio. My first novel, The Slow Way Back, was a fictionalized account of my sister and me, because I didn't think
she really got it for throwing those basketballs
at you. The writer's revenge.
Tying you to a tree.
Writer's revenge.
Shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
So you really enjoy writing the memoir. When do you write? Do you write morning, noon, and night? Do you write a on weekends? When is your best writing time?
My best writing time is first thing in the morning when I'm closest to my unconscious, when I'm closest to my dreams, before the world has entered my life, before I've talked on the phone, before I've read the paper, before I've listened to music.
Before coffee?
After coffee. After coffee. You got me there.
So there's
after
a little little consciousness.
Yes, yes. Yeah, okay. But yeah, my best time is early in the morning. But really and truly, since I've been writing for so many years, I can write any time. I mean, I've gotten up in the middle of the night and I have written. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, the hardest part for me is taking care of the rest of my life, because my desire is to sit and write. That's my ideal day, is mm-hmm. to spend it writing.
Mm-hmm. And you've gotten several awards over time. One of the awards that I focused on here was the Fortner Award for Outstanding Generosity to Other Writers and the Larger Community. Talk about your outreach to other writers and your connection to other writers and how you've, in your own career, shared your work with other writers.
Well, that was a lovely award. It really mm-hmm. was, and it meant a lot to me. Still does mean a lot to me. There have been so many writers who have been incredibly generous to me. Mm-hmm. Pat Conroy was one, mm-hmm. and I was only one of many writers, beginning writers, whom he took under his wing and just sort of ushered us through the writing mm-hmm. life, showed us what to do, where to go, how to do it. But like I say, there have been so many writers who have helped me along the way. I feel like that's what we do as writers. And writers really are generous people. Mm-hmm. I really believe that, because it's such a lonely vocation. We're by ourselves so much. So if we can reach out to other people, we're ready to.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the reasons for this podcast, is trying to connect authors to listeners and readers. And I also enjoy the connection of just sitting down with you and talking about your work and your writing and that kind of thing.
I love that, and I love that you're doing that.
Yeah. And you're so part of this support for other writers. I mean, you review other writers' work and you give them feedback, and you teach, and
yes.
you're going to speak to the Charlotte Writers Club this next year.
Oh boy, yeah. The Charlotte Writers Club means a lot to me.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And it's been around for a long time.
It has been around a long time. It's the first poem of mine that anything ever happened to.
Oh, good.
I won the poetry contest. It's the first time I sent a poem out.
Yeah, and you're also connected to the Charlotte Center for Literary Arts.
Yes, they do a fabulous job. Right. Charlotte Lit. They are a wonderful organization.
So the book that's coming out, tell us when we're going to see it on the shelves.
Well, books take so long to such a long gestation period. I'll say that. It's together. My memoir is coming out February 12th, right before Valentine's Day 2019. So we're almost there.
Right before, not on Valentine's Day?
Right before Valentine's Day. So you can give it as a Valentine's Day present on the 14th.
Okay.
Hint, hint.
That's a good one. Maybe I'll get some reprieve there from not loading and unloading the dishwasher.
Can give the book and then start loading and unloading the dishwasher.
All right. Well, Judy, this has been great. First of all, your website, where do we find you?
JudyGoldman.com.
Okay, and we find out more about your writing there. And
everything's there.
And the new book that's coming out.
And if you want to contact me, there's a way to contact me through my website.
Great. Well, Judy, thanks so much for sharing these stories today, your poetry and your work over the years, and hope you're going to write some more.
Oh, boy. Thank you, Landis, for this. What a great gift you're giving Charlotte writers and readers. Thank you.
Thank you. So that's it for today. Another author giving voice to their written words. Thank you for listening to Charlotte Readers Podcast. If you liked our show, please tell your friends. And if you really liked it, you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and by subscribing to the show wherever you listen to it, which you can do for free. Please remember our Season 1 sponsor, Park Road Books. They're right there in Park Road Shopping Center. Drop by the store. You'll be glad you did. And don't forget to check out charlottereaderspodcast.com and the free ebook you can get by signing up for our email list. Speaking of email, my email address is on the website, and I'd love to hear from you. Tell me what you like about the show. Tell me what you'd like to see different. And if you have the name of a Charlotte area author you'd like to hear from, give me the name and I'll follow up. You can like us on Facebook and tweet at us on Twitter. We're going to try to put these shows out on a weekly basis. And next week, we have another talented author coming to read their work. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.